Hausen, forgetful of the other girl's presence, advanced eagerly to meet his fiancée and kissed her, and I thought for a moment we were going to be treated to one of those nasty outbursts of spitefulness of which defectives are capable, when a sudden change came over Mona Kaylee, and I saw that marvelous thing, a soul enter and take possession of its body. Intelligence slowly dawned in the misty eyes as she watched the scene being enacted before her. For a moment the issue hung in the balance, would she rush forward and tear them apart, or would she stand aside? Behind the oblivious lovers I poised myself for a spring, ready to catch her if necessary. For ages we waited thus while the unpracticed brain moved reluctantly in its unaccustomed effort. Then the girl turned away slowly. Over the grass she moved, silently, unnoticed by the other two, seeking the shelter of the shrubberies as a wounded animal seeks cover, but her movements were no longer those of unguided limbs, she moved as a woman moves who has walked before kings, but as a woman stricken to the heart. I followed her as she passed under the trees and put my hand on her arm, instinctively speaking words of comfort, although I expected no response. She turned on me dark eyes full of unshed tears and luminous with a terrible knowledge. "It is to be," she said distinctly, perfectly, the first words she had ever uttered. Then she withdrew her arm from my hand and went on alone. During the days that followed we watched the soul swing in and out of the body. Sometimes we had the mindless imbecile, and sometimes we had one of those women who have made history. Save that her means of communication developed slowly, she was often in full possession of her faculties. And what faculties they were! I had read of the wonderful women of the Renaissance, now I saw one. Then, sometimes, when the pain of her position became too great to be borne, the soul would slip out for a while and rest in some strange Elysian fields we know not of, leaving to us again the care of the mindless body. But each time it came back refreshed. Whom it had talked with, what help had been given, we never knew, but each time it faced the agony of reincarnation and took up its burden with renewed courage and knowledge. The dim, newly awakened mind understood Hausen through and through, each twist and turn of him, conscious and subconscious, she could follow, and of course she was the most perfect nurse he could have had. The panic-stricken mind was never allowed to thrash about in outer darkness and the horror of death. Instinctively she sensed the approach of nightmare forms, and putting out her hand, pulled the wandering soul back into safety. Thus protected from the wear and tear of his terrible storms, Hausen's mind began to heal. Day by day the time drew nearer when he would be fit to leave the nursing home and marry the woman he was engaged to, and day by day, by her instinctive skill in watchful care, Mona Kaylee quickened the approach of that time. I have said that he would leave and marry the woman he was engaged to, not the woman he loved, for at that time had Mona Kaylee chosen to lift one finger she could have brought the old memories into consciousness and drawn Hausen to herself, and that she was fully aware of this, I who watched her, am convinced. An ignorant woman could not have steered round the pitfalls as skillfully as she did. The night before he was to leave she had a bad relapse into her old condition. Hour after hour Taverner and I sat beside her while she scarcely seemed to breathe, so completely was the soul withdrawn from the body. She is shut up in her own subconsciousness, moving among the memories of the past, Taverner whispered to me, as slight twitchings ran through the motionless form on the bed. Then a change took place. "Ah," said Taverner, "she is out now." Slowly the long white hand was raised, the hand that I had watched change from a limp thing of disgust to firmness and strength, and a sequence of knocks was given upon the wall at the bedside that would have skinned the knuckles of an ordinary hand. "She is claiming entrance to her lodge," whispered Taverner. "She will give the word as soon as the knocks are acknowledged." From somewhere up near the ceiling the sequence of knocks was repeated, and then Taverner placed his hand across the girl's mouth. Through the guarding fingers came some muffled sound I could not make out. "She will get what she has gone to seek," said Taverner. "It is a high degree to which she is claiming admission." What transpired during the workings of that strange lodge which meets out of the body I had no means of knowing. I could see that Taverner, however, with his telepathic faculties, was able to follow the ritual, for he joined in the responses and salutes. As the uncanny ceremony drew to its close, we saw the soul that was known to us as Mona Kaylee withdraw from the company of its brethren and, plane by plane, return to normal consciousness. On her face was that look of peace which I had never before seen in the living, and only on the faces of such of the dead as went straight out into the light. She has gathered strength for her ordeal, said Taverner, and it will indeed be an ordeal, for Howson's fiancée is fetching him in her car. Will it be wise to let Miss Kaylee be present? I asked. She must go through with it, said Taverner. It is better to break than to miss an opportunity. He was a man who never spared his patience when there was a question of fate to be worked out. He thought less of death than most people think of emigration. In fact, he seemed to regard it in exactly that light. Once you have had some memory glimpse, however dim, of your own past, you are certain of your future, therefore you cease to fear life. Supposing I make a mess of an experiment today, I clear up the mess, go to bed, sleep, and then, in the morning when I am rested, I start again. You do the same with your lives when once you are sure of reincarnation. It is only the man who does not realize as a personal fact the immortality of the soul who talks of a ruined life and opportunities gone never to return. Mona Kaylee, Taverner, and myself were on the doorstep to bid goodbye to Howson when his fiancée called to take him away. He thanked us both with evident feeling for what we had done for him. But Taverner waved a disclaiming hand towards the girl at his elbow. You have had nothing from me but board and lodging, he said. There is your psychologist. Howson took Mona's hand in both his. She stood absolutely passive, but not with her usual limp inertia. It was the motionlessness of extreme tension. Poor little Mona, he said. You are a lot better than you used to be. Go on getting better, and one of these days you may be a real girl and have a good time. And he kissed her lightly as one would kiss a child. What memories that kiss awakened I cannot say, but I saw him change color and look at her sharply. Had one glimmer of response lightened those dark eyes, the old love would have returned. But there was no change in the mask-like countenance of the woman who was paying her debt. He shivered. Perhaps some cold breath from the torturer's dungeon touched him. He got into the car beside the woman he was to marry, and she drove away. How will that marriage turn out? I asked as the sounds of the car died in the distance. Like a good many others where only the emotions are mated. They will be in love for a year. Then will come disillusionment, and after they have bumped through the crisis, held together by the pressure of social opinion, they will settle down to the mutual toleration which passes for a successful marriage. But when he comes to die, he will remember this Mona Kaylee and call for her, and as he crosses the threshold she will claim him, for they have made restitution, and the way is clear. End of this story, and next is The Scented Poppies. Mr. Gregory Polson, said Taverner, reading the card that had been brought to him. Evidently a junior member of the firm. Lincoln's Inn is where they have their abode, so they are probably solicitors. Let us have a look at him. A man's work generally puts its mark on him, and our visitor, although a comparatively young man, already showed the stamp of the legal profession. I want to consult you, he began, about a very curious matter. I cannot call it a case. It seems to me, however, that you are the only man who can deal with it, and therefore, although it may not be strictly in your line, I should be exceedingly grateful to you if you would look into it. Taverner nodded his acquiescence, and our visitor took up the burden of his story. I dare say you have heard of old Benjamin Burmister, who made such an enormous fortune during the war. We, that is, my father's firm, are his solicitors and are also personal friends of the family, or, to be exact, his brother's families, for old Mr. Burmister is unmarried. My sister and I have grown up with the two sets of Burmister cousins as if we were all one big household. In fact, my sister is at present engaged to one of David Burmister's boys, an awfully nice chap, my particular friend, in fact. We are very pleased about the engagement, for the Burmisters are nice people, although the other two brothers were not wealthy. Well, to make a long story short, After Edith and Tim had been engaged about 6 months, my people were a lot more pleased about the engagement, but I can't say that I am. However, for old Benjamin Burmister made a new will leaving his money to Tim. Why should you regard this as a disadvantage? Because the people he has left his money to have an unfortunate knack of committing suicide.
Indeed?
Yes, said our visitor, it has happened upon no fewer than 3 occasions. The will I have just completed in favor of Tim is his 4th. Murray, Tim's eldest brother, who was the last one Mr. Burmister had chosen to be his heir, jumped off a cliff near Brighton about a month ago. You say that each time Mr. Burmister makes a will, the principal beneficiary commits suicide? Said Taverner. Can you tell me the conditions of the will?
They are rather unfair in my opinion, said Gregory Polson. Instead of dividing the money among his nephews and nieces, who are none too well off, he insists upon leaving the bulk of it to one nephew. His idea seems to be that he will found a kind of dynasty. He has already purchased the country seat and that he will make one Burmister an influential man, instead of making about a dozen of them comfortable.
I see, said Tavernor, and as soon as the will is made the principal beneficiary commits suicide.
That is it, said Bolson. They have had 3 suicides in 2 years.
Tut, tut, said Taverner, as many as that? It certainly does not look like chance. Now who has benefited by these deaths?
Only the next heir, who speedily commits suicide himself.
What determines your client in his choice of an heir?
He picks the nephew whom he thinks is most likely to do him credit.
He does not follow any rule of birth.
None whatever.
He chooses according to his estimate of their character, picking the more forceful natures first. Tim is a much quieter, more retiring kind of fellow than his cousins. I was rather surprised to see old Burmister's selection fall on him, but there is not much choice now. There are only 3 boys left after these ghastly tragedies.
Then it is one of these 3 men who will ultimately benefit if another suicide takes place?
That is so.
But one can hardly conceive a criminal cold-blooded enough to kill off an entire family on the off chance that the final choice might fall upon himself.
What manner of men are these 3 remaining cousins?
Henry is an engineer, doing quite well and engaged to be married. He will never set the Thames on fire, but he is a decent chap.
He is Tim's younger brother.
Bob, Tim's cousin, is a bit of an ne'er-do-well. We have had to extricate him from a breach of promise and 1 or 2 other unpleasantness, but I should say he was a good-hearted, irresponsible lad, his own worst enemy.
The last of the family is Irving, Bob's brother, a harmless enough chap, but not fond of honest work.
Joseph Burmister's boys never did as well as David's. They inclined to the artistic rather than the practical, and that type never makes money.
Joseph's wife, however, had a fair amount, and each of her children has about 150 a year of his own, not affluence, but it keeps them out of the workhouse.
Bob does odds and ends to supplement his means. He is secretary of a golf club at present, but Irving is the family genius and has set out to be an artist, though I don't think he has ever produced anything. His sole occupation, so far as I know, is to write a monthly art criticism for a paper that thinks publicity is sufficient payment.
He will not get very fat at that rate, said Taverner.
How does he manage to exist on his 150?
He lives in a single-room studio and eats out of a frying pan.
It is not so unattractive as it sounds. However, he has extraordinarily good taste, and has got his little place quite charming.
So these are the people who might possibly benefit under the will: a steady-going engineer, a good-natured scatterbrain, and an artistic bohemian.
There were originally 7 possible beneficiaries, providing old Benjamin adhered to his policy.
3 are dead by their own hand, 1 is at present under sentence of death.
What do you mean by that?
Interrupted Taverner quickly.
Ah, said Polson, that is the thing that gave me a nasty turn, and made me come to you.
The 3 men who are dead all committed suicide in the same way, by flinging themselves from a height.
Tim was in my office yesterday. Our chambers are at the top of the building, a considerable height up. He leant out of the window for quite a while, and when I asked him what he was looking at, he said, I wonder what it would feel like to take a header onto the pavement. I told him to come in and not play the fool, but it gave me a nasty shock, coming on top of the other suicides, so I came to you.
Why to me? Asked Tavener.
I have read something of occultism and something of psychology and heard how you work the two systems in combination, said Polson, and it seemed to me that this was a case for you. There is more in this than you have told me, said Tavener.
What is it that you suspect?
I have no evidence whatever. In fact, it is the lack of evidence that has made me seek an explanation outside the normal.
Why should these men, perfectly healthy average individuals, take their own lives for no reason whatsoever?
One cannot account for it on any of the accepted theories, but if one admits the feasibility of thought transference, and pretty nearly everybody does nowadays, then it seems to me that it would be possible to give mental suggestion to these men to commit suicide.
It is not only possible, said Tavener, but in less extreme forms this exercise of secret pressure is exceedingly common.
I could tell you some curious stories in connection with the Great War in this line. Not all the men who were got at were reached through their pockets. Many were approached by the channel of their subconscious minds. But continue.
There is someone whom you are watching, subconsciously, if not consciously.
I have given you all the facts that could possibly be admitted as evidence.
I haven't got a clue that would hang a cat, but I suspect Irving.
On what grounds?
On none whatever, chiefly on the principle of I do not like you.
Dr. Fell, give me your unbowdlerized impressions of him.
He is not straight, sir.
I have never once caught him out, but I should never trust him.
Then he is in with a set I don't like the look of. They play about with hashish and cocaine and each other's wives.
They are not wholesome. I prefer Bob's Wildcat Company promoters to Irving's long-haired soul mates.
Thirdly, Irving is the last one old Benjamin would be likely to leave his money to.
I think he would leave it to Irving before he left it outside the family, for he is terribly proud of the Burmister name, but he is not at all fond of the fellow.
They never got on together. Benjamin is a rough, downright old chap, and Irving is a bit of an old maid.
Fourthly, if you knew Bob and Henry, you would know that it was out of the question that they should do such a thing, but Irving might. When a man fools with drugs, he may do anything.
Besides, he has read along the same lines as I have. In fact, it was he who first put me onto them.
Have you any reason to believe that Irving is a trained occultist?
He is interested in occultism, but I should not imagine that he would ever train in anything.
He is nothing but a dabbler.
Then he is not very likely to be able to perform a mental assassination.
Thought transference requires more effort than swinging a sledgehammer.
If you are ever offered your choice between being an occultist and a blacksmith, choose the lighter job and enter the forge rather than the lodge.
Well, you suspect Irving?
As you say, there is no evidence to hang a cat, but we will put him through the sieve and see what he yields.
Did he become very intimate with old Mr. Burmister's heirs after the wills became known?
No more so than usual. They are a united family and always saw a lot of each other. The only thing that Irving ever did that was out of the ordinary was to decorate their rooms for them. He has a wonderful taste in coloring, but then he did that for a good many of us, and designed the girls' dresses, too.
He is an extraordinary chap, who makes a hobby of that sort of thing.
He knows all the out-of-the-way shops where you can get queer brands of coffee and cigarettes, and restaurants where you can get weird food.
It has always seemed to me the sort of thing for a woman rather than a man to be interested in.
Ah, said Tavener, he designed their rooms. Now that is a peculiarly intimate thing to do. The man who designs the place you live in can exercise a great influence over your life if he knows how to make use of his opportunities.
But before we go any further afield, try and think if there was anything of any sort that the dead men had in common and the living ones have not got.
Any mode of life, possession, peculiarity, anything in fact, that differentiated them.
Polson racked his brains for several minutes.
The only thing I can possibly think of, he said at length, is a particular kind of scent that Irving manages to get hold of and gives to his particular friends. He makes a great mystery of it, but then he loves making mysteries about nothing in particular. It makes him feel important.
Come now, said Tavener, we have struck a warm trail at last. The psychological effect of scents is very great. What has our friend been playing at with his mysterious smells?
I don't know, said Polson. He probably gets it at the stores. He had some wonderful tea once that was supposed to come direct from Lhasa, and we found a Leon label round it. He is that sort of chap.
But what about this scent? Did he give it to each of the dead men and to none other?
He used to give it to his particular pals as a special favor. His great wheeze was to get those big poppy heads the chemists sell for making poultices, paint them all sorts of futurist colors, stuff them with potpourri and fix them on the end of strips of pliable cane. They really look very well in a vase, like great gaudy flowers. He gave me a bunch once, but I wasn't honored with the sacred perfume that he has in his own quarters, but Percy, one of the boys who was dead, had some, and he has given Tim a bunch. I am not sure whether they are scented or not.
Then the best thing you can do is to go round to your cousin, get hold of those poppy heads, and bring them to me to have a look at.
Polson sallied forth on his mission, and as the door closed behind him, Taverner turned to me.
You see, he said, the advantage of intuition. Poison had nothing whatever to go on, but he instinctively distrusted Irving. When he begins to suspect foul play, he proceeds to counter-check his intuitions by observation, which is a peculiarly effective method of work, for you will see how the use of the intuition is able to point out a profitable line of observation and, by means of the subtlest and most elusive of subjective clues, lead us to what promises to be solid ground. We must see what evidence the poppy heads yield, however, before we begin to theorize. There is nothing so misleading as a preconceived opinion. One is very apartment to twist the facts to fit it. We went on to other cases, and had got to the end of our appointments when the butler informed us that Mr. Polson had returned and would like to see us again. He was ushered in, bearing a long parcel in his hand, his eyes bright with excitement. Tim has been given the special scent, he cried as soon as he was inside the door. How did you manage to obtain possession of the poppy heads?
Did you tell him why you wanted them?
I told him I wanted to show them to a friend. It was no use worrying him until we have something definite to go on, or he might commit suicide by sheer outer suggestion.
Wise man, said Taverner. You have read to some purpose.
Poison unrolled his parcel, and laid half a dozen gorgeously colored poppy heads on the desk. They looked like wonderful tropical fruit, and certainly formed an acceptable present. Taverner examined them one by one. Five of them yielded nothing to his probing save a shower of fine black seeds, but the sixth exhaled a curious heavy perfume, and rattled when shaken.
This poppy head, said Taverner, is going to meet with an accident, and he crashed a paperweight down on it. Out on the blotter rolled three or four objects that looked like dried raisins, and most curious of all a fair-sized moonstone. At the sight of this we exclaimed as one man, why should anyone place a gem worth several pounds in the inside of a poppy head where it was never likely to be seen? Taverner turned over the black objects with his pencil. Scented seeds of some sort, he remarked and handed them to me.
Smell them, Rhodes. I took them in my hand and sniffed them gingerly.
Not bad, I said, but they are slightly irritating to the mucous membrane. They make me feel as if I were going to sneeze, only instead of the sneeze coming to anything, the irritation seems to run up into my head and cause a peculiar sensation as if a draft of cold air was blowing on my forehead.
So they stir up the pineal gland, do they? Said Taverner.
I think I can see some method in the gentleman's madness. Now take the moonstone in your other hand, go on sniffing the seeds, look at the moonstone, and tell me the thoughts that come into your head, just as if you were being psychoanalyzed.
I did as I was instructed.
I think of soapy water, I began. I think my hands would be improved by a Washington. I think of a necklace of my mother's. I think this stone would be very hard to find if I dropped it out of the window. I wonder what it would be like to be thrown out of the window. I wonder what it would feel like to be thrown from a height.
Does one?
That will do, said Taverner, and took the moonstone away from me. I looked up in surprise, and saw that Polson had buried his face in his hands.
My God, he said. And I used to play with that boy. I looked from one to the other of my companions in surprise. What does it all mean? I asked.
It means this, said Taverner. Someone has hit upon a singularly ingenious way of bottling psychism. A man who is incapable, by reason of his lack of development, of doing mental work on his own account, has found a way of buying occultism by the ounce. There must be a factory where they are turning out this precious product, and where an unscrupulous scoundrel like Irving can go and buy 2p and bring it away in a paper bag. I had always understood that occult work could only be done by men of unusual natural gifts who had devoted long years to their development, and this idea of taking your turn at the counter and buying the hidden powers like acid drops tickled my fancy. It was only the expression on Polson's face that prevented me from bursting out laughing. But I saw what deadly possibilities were latent in the plan that Taverner had outlined so grotesquely. There is nothing original in this scheme, said Taverner. It is simply the commercial application of certain natural laws that are known to occultists. I have always told you that there is nothing supernatural about occult science. It is merely a branch of knowledge that has not been generally taken up, and which has this peculiarity, that its professors do not hasten to publish their results. This exceedingly clever trick of the moonstone and the scented seeds is simply an application of certain occult knowledge for the purpose of crime. Do you mean, said Poison, that there is some sort of mental poison inside that poppy head? I can understand that the smell of those seeds might affect the brain, but what part does the moonstone play? The moonstone is tuned to a keynote, and that keynote is suicide, said Taverner. Someone not Irving, he hasn't got the brains, has made a very clear mental picture of committing suicide by flinging oneself from a height, and has impressed that picture, I won't tell you how, on that moonstone, so that anyone who is in close contact with it finds the same image rise into his mind, just as a depressed person can infect others with depression without speaking one single word to them. But how can an inanimate object be capable of feeling emotion? I inquired. It couldn't, said Taverner, but is there such a thing as an inanimate object? Occult science teaches that there is not. It is one of our maxims that mind is entranced in the mineral, sleeps in the plant, dreams in the animal and wakes in the man. You have only to watch a sweet pea tendril reach out for a support to realize that the movements of plants are anything but purposeless, and the work connected with the fatigue of metals is well known. Ask your barber if his razors ever get tired, and he will tell you that he rests them regularly, because fatigued steel will not take a fine edge. Granted, I said. But do you mean to tell me that there is sufficient consciousness in that bit of stone to be capable of taking in an idea and transmitting it to someone's subconscious mind? I do, said Taverner. A crystal is the highest development of the mineral kingdom, and there is quite enough mind in that stone on the table to take on a certain amount of character if a sufficiently strong influence be brought to bear upon it. Remember the history of the Hope Diamond and various other well-known gems whose records are known to collectors. It is this mental development of crystals which is taken advantage of in the making of talismans and amulets, for which the precious stones, and next to them the precious metals, have been used from time immemorial. This moonstone is simply an amulet of evil. Taverner, I said, you don't mean to tell me that you believe in charms?
Certainly.
Don't you?
Good heavens,
no, not in this enlightened age. My dear boy, if you find a belief universally held throughout all ages by races that have had no communication with each other, then you may be sure that there is something in it.
Then to put it crudely, said Polson, who had hitherto stared at Taverner in silence, you believe that someone has taught this moonstone how to give hypnotic suggestion.
Crudely, yes, replied Taverner. Just as middle C struck on a piano will cause the C string of another piano to vibrate in sympathy. How does the moonstone manage the hypnosis? I inquired.
Not without malice, I am afraid.
Ah, it has to have help with that, said Taverner. That is where those scented seeds come in, and a more diabolically ingenious device it would be hard to find. Everybody is not psychic,
So some means had to be devised of inducing at least temporary sensitiveness in the stolid, matter-of-fact Burmisters against whom this device was directed. As even you will admit, Rhodes, there are certain drugs that are capable of changing the condition and state of consciousness, alcohol for one, chloroform for another.